The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. Today is June 11th. And June 11th, for those of us who love the Ukrainian people and who are a part of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, it is a special day because it is the day when the first patriarch of an independent Ukrainian church in modern times died, Patriarch Mstislav Skirpnik. He died in 1993 at a very old age. He was in his early 90s. And I think it very proper, for a whole lot of reasons we're going to talk about here in a little while, that we talk about his life, his thought, and his views on nationalism and national socialism. This is something that Ukrainians have struggled with for some time, and I want to say that the final word on Patriarch Mstislav has not yet been stated. There's still a lot of historical research that needs to be done, and there's a lot of problems when it comes to analyzing the various difficult circumstances of Poland and Ukraine under German occupation during World War II. And because of the confusing circumstances, because of the changing points of view of the Ukrainian nationalist factions as well as the German government, both in Poland and in Ukraine, it's going to take a long time before some of these questions are teased out. And it's sort of a big deal for world history because, in my opinion, the Germans lost the war in Ukraine. The Germans lost the war relative to their attitude towards the nationalist movement, both in Russia and Ukraine, specifically the latter. And Patriarch Mstislav, of course, was not patriarch at the time, is absolutely front and center in all of these questions in the 1940s, at the very beginning of World War II, and the German occupation, both of Poland and Ukraine. So we're going to deal with Stepan Skirpnik, which was his birth name when he became a monk and then bishop. Much later on, he took the name of Mstislav, so normally we refer to him as Patriarch Mstislav of Ukraine, of the Ukrainian autocephalous or self-led Orthodox Church. The first thing that should be said about Mstislav is that he is the nephew of the famous Ukrainian nationalist leader Simon Petlura, who was what we might call a pragmatic nationalist. He did believe in Ukrainian national independence. He, for some time, sided with the Poles, especially when it was clear that the whites in the Russian Civil War were going to lose, and that the Russian Reds, or the Jewish Reds, I should say, were going to dominate Ukraine. It's worth mentioning that both white and red armies were absolutely dedicated to the subjugation of Ukraine. The only difference being that the Reds said that they were interested in independence. Of course, they never really were. But the whites were far more honest about it and said that we believe in a great Russia, which means that we want to restore the empire as it was. Mstislav is born in the very late 19th century and grows up in a highly clerical Ukrainian family. And because of his connections to Petlura and many other people, he becomes a Ukrainian nationalist early on. But it becomes clear, the Ukrainian nationalist movement had such a problem at the end of World War I because as it became more and more clear that the Reds were going to win, in Russia. The Polish, the newly constructed Polish state, began to violently take its former colonial patrimony in the provinces of Galicia and Volhynia. That meant, of course, the destruction of Ukrainian churches, Ukrainian monasteries, educational institutions, and the ethnic cleansing of those two very strategic Ukrainian provinces. So the Ukrainian nationalist movement was in big trouble fairly early on, having two hostile forces, or at one time three hostile forces, the whites and the reds, and then the Poles. But Luria's interesting quality was his ability to be able to come to a deal with the Poles, where Poland and the Ukrainians and some white factions were to join forces against the Reds. And for a short time, this actually worked. And because of this, fairly young Stepan Stepnik, who becomes Mstislav later on, will grow up an army man. He will work within the Ukrainian Army Group East, dealing with the Poles, and because of his connections, Petluria will eventually become an ambassador for the Ukrainian army in the Polish parliament. So both Petluria and Mstislav believe that the Reds could be destroyed by making peace with the Poles. Now, none of this means that he ever rejected the concept of Ukrainian independence. He always believed in this. Of course, the Ukrainian nationalist movement was dedicated to this sort of thing. But he realized that in the 1920s, this is a very, very difficult road to hoe. And like his very famous uncle, he became somewhat, I want to qualify this, he became somewhat of a Polonophile, especially when he realized that the new Polish government was fairly easy to work with by contrast to either the Russian Reds or the Whites. And Mstislav, early on, showed two qualities that is really going to define his career for the next 90 years. And that is his tremendous speaking ability. He was an orator of the first rank. Everybody, including his enemies, say that. And secondly, he was a tremendous organizer. He had a fiery temper. He was intensely passionate in the best sense of the word. Now, in spite of his early Poloniophilia, it was true that once he became a priest, he does come from a clerical family, once he became a priest in the province of Volhynia in Ukraine, he was persecuted by the Poles, and Ukrainian parishes in that area were shut down. So his early life is a very difficult one. It's essentially as a nationalist parish priest in either Galicia or Volhynia, both on the one hand supportive of the Poles against the communists, and on the other hand persecuted by the Poles for being a Ukrainian nationalist. It's a very difficult, very complicated ethnic situation in the 1920s. And to a great extent, the Red Armies are going to be able to use that division to come to victory. And as you all know, after World War II, we'll take all of Ukraine, as a Soviet Socialist Republic, where prior to that, it had only been East or Left Bank Ukraine that was a part of the Soviet Union. But by 1940, Mstislav's abilities were recognized. And in the Tronsky Rada, the diocese of that area, he was elected chairman of the parliament in that area. And not too long after that, he was consecrated a bishop by the Metropolitan Nicanor. Now, one of the questions that hasn't been solved is that when he was a married man with children, his wife was murdered. And no one is quite sure why, maybe the why isn't the problem, it's really more the who. But that has not been solved. It's very possible it could have been a part of the Polish movement a part of the Red Army. Either way, his nationalism was irritating to both Poles and Russian and Jewish Reds. And so once his wife was killed, it was clear that his organizing abilities were needed, and he was consecrated bishop by seven bishops total, and the leading bishop was Nicanor, who himself comes from the line of Dionysia of Poland. And Dionysia was consecrated by the Greeks both in Constantinople and at Antioch. So his line in terms of his clerical world, this happens to be my line as well, by the way, is impeccable for that reason. And that we all come from Dionysia of Warsaw, who was an ethnic Russian, but largely was in charge of the Ukrainian church in Poland, because Ukrainians make up a large minority of the Polish population. The big issue is Mstislav relative to the National Socialist movement. I want to say, first of all, that Mstislav, to a great extent, was a social nationalist in his basic political point of view. His relationships with the Germans are highly controversial. The Russians always wanted to claim that he was 100% pro-NS, and to a great extent, he was pro-National Socialist. And that was the case also with Nicanor and Polycarpus and so many of the other major bishops of the Ukrainian church at the time. I want to stress that the Ukrainian independent church that Mstislav was eventually to lead is extremely Germanophile. This is nothing that Mstislav or Nicanor or Igor Polycarpus or any of these people wanted to hide. They believed that Germany, and specifically Adolf Hitler, was going to lead the Ukrainian people to independence. Or at the very least, that Hitler was going to lead the Ukrainian people to an integral existence where they could function as a single ethnic unity. This is something that was held consistently throughout the 1930s and 1940s by the Ukrainian autocephalous Orthodox Church. And it's the frustration of that movement that became Hitler's downfall on the Southeastern Front. And it reached a point where the German government in Poland, as well as in Ukraine, refused to permit the Ukrainian nationalist bishops, including Mstislav and Nicanor, to serve at all. And both Polycarpus and Mstislav referred to Hitler as a great leader, a providential leader, someone who was going to lead the Slavic peoples to independence. Now, the question of the organization of Ukrainian nationalists is another matter, because they initially supported the German invasion. They worked with the German invasion. But once they got wind of the SS's policies under Koch in Ukraine, that became a bit of an issue. And eventually the OUN will shift gears. That's probably, and I want to stress probably, not the case relative to the UASC in Ukraine and Poland. And up until 43-44, when it was clear that nothing was going to happen, both Nicanor and Polycarp and the new bishop, Mstislav, generally supported German activities in invading the Soviet Union, hopefully destroying Stalin, and in the bargain, creating a large, wealthy, fertile, allied state in Ukraine. And I want to say, and I'm probably going to say this till the day I die, no one ever listens, but the fact is, if Hitler and his high command in the Southeast had followed this point of view, the Soviet Union would have been destroyed fairly early on, but he did not. Whether it was Hitler's fault or whether it was Koch's fault, I know Koch really has this terrible reputation among Ukrainians. Some, like Richard Lanier, even claim that he was a Soviet spy, Soviet agent. I don't know if that's true, but this particular area, this particular strategy was not followed. And the bulk of the Ukrainian nationalists by 1944, or even before that, had refused to fight for Hitler, and then ended up in the suicidal guerrilla world of fighting two major powers at the same time. I want to make it clear that the Ukrainian church under Nikanor and Polycarpus was fully National Socialist. And in fact, even Metropolitan Dionysia, when he was evacuated to Germany, took positions within the German government and strongly, I mean, as a religious figure, and very strongly supported the National Socialist drive against Marxism. Even more than this, in spite of this kind of ridiculous seesaw back and forth concerning the issue of the Ukrainian nationalists and specifically the autocephalous Orthodox movement, the German government in Poland, rather than in Ukraine, the German government in Poland was very much in favor of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church and as an independent anti-Moscow Orthodox Church, and did everything it could to recognize it, to promote it, to do what was necessary to develop the Ukrainian ethnic consciousness. But given that fact, my conclusion is, and I'm willing to be proven wrong here, but my conclusion is that it's Cook in Ukraine that caused the problem. That he was the one who irritated the Ukrainian nationalist movement to the extent that they turned against the NS movement. And yet the German government in Poland did just the opposite. It promoted the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, and it was in Poland that the Ukrainian minority was organized under Metropolitan Dionysia, who remains a saintly and a very, very powerful a theological as well as political figure. I also want to make something clear. Mstislav, in his young years as a bishop, viewed Germany under the National Socialist government as a means not merely to liberate Ukraine from Stalin, but also as a means to militarily unify the Ukrainian ethnos from Eastern Hungary to Poland to parts of Austria to Ukraine proper, to create a single pro-German, Germanophile, allied Ukrainian government. And Mstislav, in 1944, when the Eastern Front was pretty much, you know, crumbling, he moved to Germany, and the Ukrainian autocephalous movement also itself moved to Germany and continued to support the National Socialist movement there. It should be noted that in spite of all of that, the U.S. Government after the war appointed Mstislav as one of the commanders of the Ukrainian ethnic displaced persons camp. And I know several people, I know them personally, who were in places like Remagen and elsewhere, in displaced persons camp, after the war, who knew Mstislav and who respected him as an organizer and a true nationalist. So even though Mstislav had supported the NS movement in general, he still was considered the legitimate leader, as a religious figure, of the displaced persons of Ukrainian background. And he was in the western zone, I really should say, of the displaced persons. So he was in the American zone for a while. I want to say a few things about Mstislav as a writer and as a philosopher. He was a man of a tremendous erudition, although it was largely based on practical ethnic and national concerns. He did not like the Jews. He believed that the Jews were the cause of Marxism, of liberalism, of the basic carnal mentality, and Mstislav, as well as Nikanor and others, believe that the Jews should be removed from Europe and sent to the Middle East. And in this regard, they were imitating Hitler, and they were imitating so many of the anti-Jewish activists in Europe at the time. He didn't believe that there was any such a thing as an independent Ukraine or even an independent state in general without a strong level of religious faith. In other words, national tradition, ethnic tradition is fine as far as it goes, but it can become a dead letter. It has to be vivified with the spiritual world. Without that vivification, it becomes nothing. It just becomes a musty museum piece. He believed, as far as Ukraine was concerned, he believed in a firm unity, not just in administration, but in the day-to-day life of the people, of the unity of church and state. That there is no distinction, because to be a Ukrainian was to be an Orthodox person. End of story. The Ukrainian ethnos came into existence because of the Orthodox battle against the Uniates, against the Protestants, against the Russian Orthodox, against the Turks, against the Jews. Well, given that history and given that single ingredient that led this fight, you can't have a Ukraine without Orthodoxy. You can't have a Ukraine without its own autocephalous or self-governing church. I also want to make it clear, though, that as he supported the National Socialist movement throughout Europe, he didn't like the idea in Ukraine itself, and this did not happen in Poland as much, he didn't like the idea of tremendous German influence. He was opposed to it. He was quite willing to hold to the view that there could be a large, strong, fertile Ukrainian state allied with the NS movement. It's another matter to say that he was somehow in favor of Ukraine becoming a colony of Germany. Mstislav realized that he needed the Germans, he needed the NS mentality, and he needed the military acumen of Hitler to be able to not only unify Ukraine as an ethnic unit, but also to destroy Stalin and thereby create Ukrainian independence. He was not willing to do that at the expense of an actual Ukrainian independent state. He would have been fully happy being allied with Germany, but that's another matter. It's not the same thing as colonial status. There is, in some recent work, oh, by the way, I should make it clear that everything I'm saying here comes strictly from Ukrainian language sources. Some of the machine translations are very, very bad. You can't rely on them. But there are mountains and mountains of material there in fairly simple Ukrainian that with some preparation you can read and begin to grasp what Mstislav was really all about. And one of the things that only exists right now in Ukrainian, I don't speak German, so I don't know what's going on there, but writers who have dealt in Ukrainian on Mstislav have said that German military intelligence documents are contradictory. In Poland, they seem to like the idea of a unified Ukrainian Orthodox movement that they could use against the Marxists. They see as a healthy, integral national and religious unit. On the other hand, in Ukraine, there seems to be a great degree of warning by the same military intelligence against any concept of a Ukrainian unified organization. Mstislav, should be noted, throughout this period of time, was involved in missionary work amongst all Ukrainians, including some Russians and Germans, within the displaced persons camp, as well as in Left Bank, or Soviet-occupied Ukraine, really for this last 20-year period, from the 30s and 40s. And in fact, in 1942, in Left Bank, Ukraine, he engaged in a tremendous amount of organizing, including mass baptisms and the consecration of many, many priests, or at least assisting in consecrating of priests, and building Ukrainian Orthodox and nationalist movement in that part of the country. Again, backtracking a little bit, at the end of the war, it was Koch who took full control of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church on Ukrainian soil. And this is where Mstislav is going to have some of his problems with not so much National Socialism or Germany, but with the administration in Ukraine. This is sort of a big deal, and I think we have to make this very, very clear. Mstislav was always a social nationalist. His whole UAOC movement was social nationalist. There's absolutely no doubting that. The problem is the person of Koch and the German administration in Ukraine, which, you know, as the Eastern Front crumbled, it became it did everything in its power to destroy any sense of an alliance between Ukrainians and Germans. And Mstislav always remained a Germanophile. The Ukrainian church always remained Germanophilic. And I think to a great extent that still remains today. All right, let's take a break. We're going to finish up when we get back. We're going to talk about the rest of Mstislav's life. He only died in 93. And we're going to talk about his work and his legacy. He went into exile in America and Canada, and then eventually, in 1990, was elected Patriarch of an independent Ukraine. So, we'll be right back. Hang in there.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. Today, June 11th, is the 17th anniversary of the death of Patriarch Mstislav of Ukraine. And he's somebody, while he gets an awful lot of attention in the Ukrainian community, does not get any attention in the nationalist community. And I'm here to say, and I think I have tons of evidence that says that he should receive far more attention. And I want to say that here you have a man whose work from the 1940s to his death in 93 was dedicated to the fusion of the Orthodox vision in terms of, you know, theology with the National Socialist vision of the nation and a true social Christianity. This is what Mstislav's world was all about. And I want to make it clear that the reason that the Soviet government, I shouldn't say the Soviet government, the Russian Orthodox Church, to this day, refuses to have anything to do with the Ukrainian autocephalous church that Mstislav helped found in the 20th century, is that they can't handle the fact that the Ukrainians, the Ukrainian nationalists, and certainly the church above all, sided with Germany in World War II and its attack on Stalinism. A lot of people forget that it was Mstislav, as bishop in Philadelphia in 1954, that testified in front of Congress about the slaughter of Ukrainian Christians under the Soviet Union, of the activities of the KGB in the U.S. And I'll do you one better. I'm willing to make the claim, and it's a guarded claim, but some of the work of Joe McCarthy was influenced by Bishop Mstislav's testimony before Congress in the early 1950s. Because it was Mstislav who, as a Ukrainian national, As a man, now bishop in Philadelphia, he was bishop in Paris and France before that, that this man knew firsthand the work of the Red Army, the work of the NKVD, its operation among the Ukrainian diaspora, among the Russian diaspora in Western Europe and America. And if we're going to have an authority to hang our hat on, why not this individual who knows this stuff from the inside? To some extent from the inside. That might be a stretch on my part, but I don't think it's insane that the congressional testimony of Patriarch Mstislav and other Ukrainian bishops in 1954 had a lot to do with what the regime calls the Red Scare. Anyway, that being said, Mstislav had, if you know, for the rest of the program here, I want to talk about Mstislav as a writer and as a philosopher, as a social philosopher, and what it means for Christianity, what it means for the Orthodox world in particular. And remember what I said. Mstislav is dedicated to the fusing of the social nationalist vision with the Orthodox Church. That's his whole world, and it comes not merely from his connection with his famous uncle in the 1920s, but also from his support of Germany, and the entire Ukrainian autocephalous Orthodox Church, its support of Germany in World War II. And I want to reiterate that it's precisely for this reason that the Russian church wants nothing to do with the Ukrainians and wants nothing to do with the Ukrainian autocephalous movement and has put pressure, because of its great size, on any church body that wants to recognize the Ukrainian Orthodox Church as it stands today. I want to say, first of all, that Mstislav was a communalist and a populist in the best sense of the word. He didn't believe that churches or any other organization should function from the top down. Everything functioned only because the people, the faithful Orthodox people in his case, wanted it. Everything that functions in Ukraine has to start from the bottom up or it has no validity. That's the main issue. I want to say that as patriarch, he's elected patriarch in 1990. He will die 3 years later. I guess he was 92 when he was elected patriarch, which was kind of, you know, iffy because of his advanced age. But he was unanimously elected patriarch in 90. That there was about 700 people, bishops and priests and laymen who were there that were involved in his election. It was a unanimous election, but even though he was very elderly, they wanted to give him a fitting reward for his services over all this period of time, the entire 20th century almost. And so they elected him patriarch. As patriarch, he made several claims, and these claims show up in a document that he wrote close to his death called his Testament. I have never seen, I don't think an English translation exists anywhere of his testament. I struggled through the original Ukrainian, of this. The machine translation is absolutely useless, when you're trying to figure this stuff out. So I had to read it myself, which was agonizing. But I got through it and I want to summarize it, in philosophical terms. Number one. Mstislav believed in a social Christianity. That is to say that the Orthodox Church has to deal with national, cultural, political, and economic issues at every level. It isn't just the thing that you do on Sunday. It isn't just the thing you do on feast days. It's something that has to be a part of your life, the life of the society, the life of the government, the life of the armed forces. It is a militant Christianity. It is a militant, ethnic, orthodox, nationalist Christianity dedicated to the preservation of Ukrainian independence, but most of all, for the salvation of all who come to it in faith. His clerical background is impeccable. He comes from and was consecrated by the Ukrainian Orthodox Church in Poland under Dionysia. And Dionysia also by the way, very pro-National Socialist, and eventually you lived in Germany at the end of the war. Number two, Mstislav believed that the Orthodox Church and its teachings on how we live is at the core of what it is to be Ukrainian. And if you've listened to anything I've done on this show, I have made that the center of everything that I am. There is no such thing as a Ukrainian world or identity unless it is based on the Orthodox faith, especially in relation to the Poles and the Uniates. Number three, as I've said before, the church, the work of the Spirit, the life of the people, elevates the ethnic traditions. Ethnic traditions are fine, but they only take on an eternal significance when they are vivified by the Spirit. I wanna clarify something here. I've written on this topic many, many times before, but I have both defined and justified the ethnic group based on this concept. The essence of a thing is based on how that thing works to survive. In the development of an ethnic group, what becomes ethnic tradition is based upon how that ethnic group has suffered and struggled in order to survive. It's those entities that worked, those things, those objects, those ideas, attitudes, that worked in preserving independence or some modicum of peace in the midst of war or foreign oppression, whatever it is. These things come to be known as the ethnic markers of a people. But even those things that become distinct of an ethnic group, these things have eternal significance only if they are consecrated to God through Jesus. That's the only time they receive eternal rather than temporary significance. While language might change and ethnic groups might change a little bit, the faith never does. At least in the Orthodox world, it never does. So, in Mstislav's thought, the church elevates the national tradition into something eternal. The church is also the creative element in the people. When you think of the struggles, the Ukrainian population, the Orthodox population against Polish occupation, Jewish occupation, German occupation for a short time, Soviet occupation, even Turkish occupation for a relatively short time. Numerous depopulations, numerous attempts at genocide throughout its history, the complete elimination of the Ukrainian nation and language and way of life. When you think of all of that stuff that has then permitted the nation to exist and therefore the individuals to exist, you think of the creative potential. How the people can develop given that reservoir of strength that they can draw from. And that next, there is no nation. There is no nation on the planet without faith. There's got to be a faith in God, in providence, in destiny, and purpose. Without that, there is no nation. You can't have a nation without those things. At the same time, Mstislav did hold, in the early 1990s, when he was patriarch, that a strong ethnic Ukrainian state government needs to function to maintain its independence. Ukraine lost a substantial percentage of its GDP due to its independence and the destruction of the Soviet Union and the implosion of Russia. The Jewish oligarchs brought a huge percentage of the Ukrainian economy abroad, to Israel, to the U.S. And Mstislav was aware of this. Mstislav always recognized the Jewish connection to Marxism and now the Jewish connection to the oligarchs. He had no illusions about that, and realized that a strong state was necessary, like you see in Belarus today, in order to control the activities of the Jewish oligarchs. And he doesn't even hold that, in the midst of all of this, that there is such a thing as a Ukrainian independent state without the existence of an independent Ukrainian church. And that this Ukrainian church has to function as a communal day-to-day part of the life of the people. It needs to be in the factories, it needs to be in the farms, it needs to be in government offices. This isn't about retreating to a monastery, although there are many monasteries in Ukraine, and there's nothing the matter with that. That mentality has to become public. And lastly, that the history of the Ukrainian population and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church needs to be part of the day-to-day life of the people. Building and understanding what a Ukrainian, a real Ukrainian Orthodox history is absolutely central. Okay, so what are we left with? Mstislav's legacy is venerated by all nationalist Ukrainians and by all Orthodox Ukrainians. There is absolutely no exception to this whatsoever. That's sort of that's an axiom. But in Ukraine today, we have a very serious problem in that we have more than one group calling itself the Ukrainian Church. After the death of Mstislav 17 years ago today, one faction elected a man, a very good man, very holy man, Dmitry Yerema, as patriarch, and another faction elected Patriarch Vladimir Romanyuk. And it's Patriarch Vladimir it's his patriarchate that my personal clerical orders and the orders of the Milan Synod, to which I belong, derive. At the same time, I want to make it clear that both factions still exist, and yet they maintain an informal communion with each other. And they certainly recognize each other's sacraments. That remains a problem. And of course, the Russian Church from Moscow, which was created in 1943 by the KGB or the NKVD, and maintains its existence in Moscow, has its own, Metropolitan, Vladimir Sabadan, in the eastern part of Ukraine. And so, it remains a substantial problem, but that shouldn't alter the fact that Mstislav has a tremendous legacy in the country. Now, as to the question of so-called recognition, I want to make it clear that the Orthodox Church, this is not a papal institution. Recognition by Greeks or Romanians, that has nothing to do with the validity of a church. It simply is an irrelevancy. What matters, number one, is the faith of the people, and number two is where your bishops receive their consecration. Of course, I've already talked about that, and that we come from Dionysia of Warsaw, who was consecrated by the Patriarch of Antioch in Syria. So there's no question as to that canonical validity. The only question is the simple fact that the Soviet Union and now the Patriarch under the current Russian government has put a lot of pressure, especially financial pressure, on those groups within the Orthodox world who are willing to recognize the Ukrainian autocephalous movement. The Ukrainian Autocephalous Church has created two anti-communist Orthodox groups in Russia, the Russian True Orthodox Church under Vyacheslav, the Russian True Orthodox Church under Raphael, who in turn have created the Russian True Orthodox Church in Kiev under Andrei, that remains in communion with Metropolitan Methodia. And of course, the group that I'm a part of, the Milan Synod, derives from the Patriarch of Vladimir Romanyuk, to the extent that our group came into communion with him, and then he blessed our synod and our work in our group. So, yes, Mstislav was a man of tremendous principle. He was a social nationalist. He was a supporter of the Third Reich. He believed that the Third Reich could destroy Stalin and thereby create an independent Ukrainian state. My opinion is that it is the work of the German government in Ukraine under Koch that destroyed that possibility. And Mstislav, Nikanor, Polycarpus, this group of Ukrainian bishops, tremendously influential, who were leaders of several thousand parishes in Western Ukraine and monasteries, they wanted to see a large, ethnically conscious, wealthy, agrarian Ukrainian state allied with Germany and a partner with Germany in creating the new order of Europe in the world. And yet, some of the people who Hitler trusted in Southeast Europe stabbed him in the back and, quite frankly, destroyed any chance, not only of a German victory in the war, but of any belief that the Slavic peoples will assist that movement any further. And I'm willing to hold that Hitler did not believe that stuff personally, but there were some close to him who did. And Koch was the worst of all, and Koch was so bad to the Slavs that even people like Richard Lindwehr are willing to say that Koch was a Soviet agent. So some of this stuff has yet to be fully disentangled. This is of global importance, and that means that Patriarch Mstislav is of global importance. And that should tell you something about the Ukrainian Orthodox vision, our vision of nationalism and national socialism and what the future might hold as the New World Order shows itself bankrupt in so many different ways, not the least of which is financial. Just as a side note here, folks, this is going to be my last show for a while. I'm going to be traveling all summer. I have a few things planned. I don't know. I'll be back in the fall sometime. I have a lot of research to do in these areas, and hopefully I'll get back to you guys fairly soon. I want you to be patient, and I don't know what's going on. I haven't been online in a long time. I don't know what's going on at the Voice of Reason, but I want to thank everybody there, my opponents as well as my friends. I want to apologize for anyone to anyone who I've offended, because I am a very offensive individual in most respects, and I want to apologize to anybody who I've hurt, and I want to thank everyone at the Voice of Reason for assisting me here, and I will be back eventually, hopefully to continue this show. In the meantime, I do check my email, so please contact me that way, and I'll be happy to talk with you. Again, thank you, and God bless.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
You're tuned into Radio Aryan.